Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are pleased to welcome back Bob Fitzwilson, founder and managing partner of the Portola Group, one of the financial advisory groups we endorse here at Peak Prosperity. And I've invited Bob to join us again to share his views on just how to navigate some of the most unusual, if not difficult, investing conditions anyone is likely to experience in their lifetime, if not ever. As mentioned on my prior podcast with Bob, there is a business relationship between his firm and Peak Prosperity, the details of which are clearly spelled out in the write-up accompanying this podcast. Oh, Bob, I'm really excited to have you back in the program to discuss investments, investing in these crazy markets.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start with a broad view of these markets. In your several decades of experience, I guess we can call it, of investment management, how do these recent markets stack up?
Well, I've been doing this about 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this. This is the most difficult, vexing set of conditions that any of us have ever seen, in part because it's not only a combination of a lot of cross currents in the markets, but you've got financial repression going on at the same time, and you have the things that you've highlighted, that there are resource constraints that are coming into play here too.
Well, let's talk about an important cross current. I see oil trading today at $106 a barrel in the U.S., $109 on the global markets as measured by Brent. Those seem to be a really high price to be building a strong case for a rapid return to robust growth, isn't it?
Yes, but I would say there are at least a couple things going on. One is that it is, you know, with all the tension in the Middle East, I mean, it's not a surprise that there'd be a bid under the price of oil. But I also think, you know, we've seen some very large inventory drawdowns. And so I think the demand for oil is a lot higher than what's being reported. But to your point, rising oil, rising gas prices, that's just another body blow that the consumer is going to have to take.
Well, let's talk about that as a cross current then, because obviously, you know, high oil price is not very conducive to rapid growth. But if it's indicating, of course, something beyond Middle East tensions, such as rising demand in the U.S., if taking that at face value, do you have any other confirming evidence to support the idea that there are pluses stacking up in the U.S. economy right now?
There are some. You know, the leading indicators are heading up. The new orders for durable goods have broken out to the upside. But, you know, there's some severe negatives. I mean, you know, real disposable income is taking a nosedive. Retail sales are in a downtrend. Auto sales are in a nosedive. And so, you know, we've got a situation where in the paper markets, if you look at the headline indexes, it seems like everything's hunky-dory. But the underlying economy is weak. Now, there are pockets. I mean, you know, we're headquartered in Silicon Valley, and I don't think I've ever seen San Jose to San Francisco as strong as it's ever been right now. So you can't say that the entire economy is weak. There are definitely pockets, but in terms of the broad statistics, you've got a market heading in one direction, and you've got the normal economic indicators heading the other.
Well, the broad markets and underlying indicators can part ways, I guess, during periods of unusual monetary excess. And for that, we might turn to the European economy, which, by the way, anything you mentioned for the U.S., we can multiply by some whole number as being worse. In Europe, looking at auto sales hitting not just recent lows, but I think multi-decadal lows and factory orders plummeting for Germany, all kinds of things going down. And yet, as I scan over, I look at the German DAX index, right near an all-time high, FTSE, right near an all-time high. What does that tell us?
Well, you know, and I'm not the first person to use this phrase, but we're kind of investing in a hall of mirrors. You know, this isn't supposed to happen. There can't be a sustainable gap between the measures of how an economy is doing, such as the stock market, and the underlying factors. And, you know, so it is true that there are companies, particularly larger companies, that have done very well, and there are some small and medium-sized companies that have done very well, but you can't have a situation where the population, you know, with unemployment high and real disposable income coming down, without eventually there being a discontinuity. So, you know, from our standpoint, what the Federal Reserve has to do, you know, to keep, and what they've done for some time is there's always been sort of a connection between the GDP and the health of the economy and the workers and the markets. And so now we have this widening gap. And so something has, there can't be a continuing rise in equity indicators in having the real economy heading in the wrong direction.
But that's been where we've been for quite a while. How would you know that that's coming to an end? Or, I mean, really only one of two ways to resolve this, right? The economy really has to pick up, but I think it was even Goldman Sachs that pegged second half growth at about 1%, cutting their recent estimate by 50%. And that's pretty fair, I think. And that's a headline number, too, which includes all the statistical wiggles and jiggles that are applied to make it potentially look better than it is and doesn't factor out things that maybe ought to be, like government deficit spending, things like that. So we look at a headline number like 1%, and it doesn't seem likely, at least from where I'm sitting at this point, that the economy is going to rise to the stock market. Do you disagree? And if not, and if so, what's left is an option?
No, I agree. We've been heading towards some sort of a cliff, and having him walk it down from 4%, 3%, 2%, 1% is like saying, I think we're slowing down.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
The cliff keeps coming. And so, you know, I mean, to me, from a logic standpoint, there's something like $1.7 trillion of reserves sitting with the Fed. And, you know, printing, I think they have to continue the QE, because somebody's got to fund the deficit for sure, and I think that QE really is about keeping interest rates down as much as anything else. And so if we're trying to create inflation, trying to get the economy going, somehow they've got to get that $1.7 trillion off the balance sheet, back to the banks, and get it into the system, and then I could see the real economy picking up and catching up with the markets. But so far that hasn't happened.
Well, even if they did do something like right now, those excess reserves sit at the Fed. They're earning 0.25% right now. So that sounds pretty nominal, but 0.25% of $1.7 trillion is real money. And if the Fed reversed that and started charging 0.25% to hold it, obviously that money would come flooding back out into the banks. But then the banks would have to do something with it. Who would they loan it to, or what else could a bank do with it? So what would they do with that money if they weren't keeping it with the Fed, do you think?
Well, anecdotally, you hear that it's terribly difficult to get a residential loan. It's terribly difficult if you're a small business to get a loan. I mean, that's where they have to get the money back to the people that are creating jobs. And so, again, if we take them at their word that they're trying to get the economy going and trying to get inflation in the system, that would be the way that I would do it. But you and I were chatting. It's kind of against cross purposes to try and get inflation going, but then report inflation net of food and energy.
Yes.
So, and this gets back to how you started out the conversation. It's a very, very confusing, murky, opaque environment for investors. And, you know, whether you're doing it professionally or you're doing it yourself, everybody should realize that this is, you know, none of us have ever seen anything like this. And so from our standpoint, you try to find things, the few things that are remaining that are reasonably trustworthy, and one of those is cash flow. So when we look at companies that we might have an interest in, cash flow is probably the number one thing that we're looking for. And there are plenty of companies out there that are generating lots of cash flow. Corporate profits are flagging to heading down, but cash flow is heading up again. In the metals markets, you know, I finally realized that the paper markets are, in essence, it's a virtual gladiator contest between people who have fiat for margin, who then create fiat contracts, and so that particular game it's really going to be won by the people who have the biggest ability to create fiat money and fiat contracts, and so that game could continue for some time. But what's different is that we're getting signs that the physical market is extremely tight, gold and backwardation, for example. And so from our standpoint, you know, the price that gets reported, you know, it's hovering, it seems to be capped around 1300 for gold and 20 for silver. I mean, that could go on forever, and it's kind of torture to sit there and watch it. You know, will it cross or won't it? Because that those markets are being massaged, shall we say. But the thing we would focus in on are the stories about the depletion of the ETFs and the vaults and then backwardation. So there are a handful of things, whether you're looking at companies or you're looking at metals. Another thing that's happening as we speak is the miners are definitely reversing course. So while the metals may be flat, the quality miners are going up substantially. So that's something, that's real. Given how far they've been driven down, you can look at those prices, and if those are reversing, they're at least communicating that a reversal may be in hand, and the metals could follow.
Well, when I used to trade gold and silver on the futures market, I would never dream of trading either set of contracts without having a whole stream of miners up on my screen. I had my own sort of sub-index, but you could use the Huey or the MX would be suitable as well, because I found that action in the miners usually preceded any change in the underlying futures market for gold or silver. And I just attributed that to the idea that there, whoever's playing those markets does so on long-short positions on the equities in miners. They do it on the futures market with gold and silver. They probably did it in ETFs, and they were probably using puts and calls and other things in on all of those. So these markets have very, very big players on them who are running strategies that don't have to have anything to do with fundamentals. Took me a while to learn that, but it's absolutely true. They only care about making money. They do it both ways. They do it with significant size advantage in the market. So they're busy rooting things around, and I'm sure it all makes sense on paper, and I'm sure they're recording some very nice fiat gains for themselves. And underneath it all, I noticed that the flow of gold from east to west has got strong and is yet to abate, and we're seeing a lot of difficulties in miners across the world, South African ones in particular. And so there's just a very fundamental supply-demand story, but things can really get out of whack for a while in the paper markets, particularly when you have this much funny money sloshing around, distorting everything. The question, I guess, is how can you be confident that any signals you're seeing at all are real ones in this environment if you don't trust the price signals so much?
Well, that's why we go back to the backwardation. I mean, there's signals. I mean, it's hard to trust anything. I mean, that's one of the things that makes it so bizarre is that, investment management, the foundation of it was usually pretty reliable, and now everything is suspect, and so there's just a handful of things you can watch, and I think you just have to be patient and sit there and let the events happen, not trying to guess who's doing what to whom or when it's going to start, just wait until it happens. And so, with these miners, for example, there's a company that we're familiar with that just reported recently, and they had a fantastic report, despite the fact that the prices received for their products were over 30% lower. And so, you can't think of them in terms of adjectives like miners. You have to, and this is where the stock picking comes in, that you have to really go dive deep, and you have to you can start with a category or a sector, but then you have to go down company by company and see what they're really doing. And so they're good miners and they're bad miners. So it's critical. I think the mistake people are making is to sort of view it as a binary situation, looking too much perhaps at the macro. And people may be right about, where the macro is heading globally, but there's still plenty of opportunities to make money. And there are frankly more companies that show up on our screens than it's hard to deal with all the potential good investments, but you have to do that. And so if you sift through 500 of them, maybe you'll find four or five, but that's more than enough to complement the position somebody might have in the energy and the metals and mining. And wait for the maintain your conviction, but then just wait for eventually some form of market reaction to bring things back into some price discovery.
Well, let's go back to one of those measures that you're using, the cash flow. So one of the things I track, obviously, is looking at earnings. Earnings projections are usually start out really, really robust and rosy and get whittled down as the year goes on. This year has been no different in that respect. And some of the forwards earnings growth that I think consensus analysts are putting forward seem a bit high to me. Let's just be kind about that going forward into the next year. But as I look at those, I'm seeing erosion in overall earnings growth, but you're looking at cash flows. Just to get wonkish for a second, are you looking at free cash flows or cash flows from operations? Are you isolating that at all? What are you looking at there?
Free cash flow. And so the tricky part is that, you know, there have been a number of companies that have done really well, some for good reasons, some for bad. I mean, the bad side of it, or the difficult side, is that companies haven't hired, they've used more technology, and so they've been able to get more profitable and build up a lot of cash flow. There have also been companies that just benefited from the environment and, you know, executed properly, and they've generated a lot of cash flow. So one of the questions is that because of all the QEs that we've had, that there's been all this money out there, that shrinking handful of companies did well, and so you can't project it forward. So one has to be careful about that. But you want to marry the cash flow with companies that are growing. You know, it's common sense. I mean, there are a lot of themes, really interesting common sense themes. You know, like food is one. I mean, whether it's Fukushima or GMO and things like that, I mean, companies that are providing food products that the consumer can rely upon. I mean, that has to be a growth industry independent of all this monetary stuff. You know, technology, I mean, again, from San Francisco to San Jose, I mean, it's an amazing variety of high-tech companies. It's not like it was during the 70s or 80s when it was just specific groups like semiconductors or disk drive manufacturers. It's, you know, it's med tech, it's high-tech, it's social media. I mean, it's a lot of productivity-related things. So Silicon Valley alone, or from to north to San Francisco, there's a whole area where one can search for opportunities. And Texas, we've talked about that. Texas is another, you know, the whole energy sector. You know, it also seems like there's been sort of a renaissance because of the relative abundance of new energy that we're developing in the United States. You hear stories about companies bringing operations back, or foreign companies bringing operations here. So my advice is people should maintain their beliefs, maintain their macro allocations, but then while they're waiting for those to happen, then sharpen your pencil and use your head and see if you can find things that are going to make sense regardless of this.
Well, there's always going to be something being sold and done. I mean, the economy always has some movement to it, and no matter what's going on, and that's true in Greece at this moment. So it's certainly there's some spots there, and you mentioned this renaissance in manufacturing. Specifically, that's around natural gas, and it makes sense at $4 a therm. The spread between the BTU cost of natural gas to oil is very, very high right now. Natural gas being cheap in that spread. And it's a feedstock for everything from fertilizers to plastics to there's even Sasol from South Africa is thinking of coming and doing a gas to liquids plant so that they can convert natural gas into diesel. These are all just ideas that pop up, not because necessarily it's a great idea from an energy standpoint. It's not, but it is a great idea from an economic standpoint with prices this cheap. But it's an interesting story they're developing. If you look at natural gas that's coming out of the ground, you know, the conventional headlines tell you there's just endless amounts and more is coming out. And that's not the case anymore. It's actually flattened out quite a lot because guess what? You lose money when you drill at $4 a therm into the formerly biggest place, which would be Haynesville and Barnett and places like that. You can't get it. You can't get in and out of there at anything less than $7.50 to $8 a therm. So guess what? There are no rigs operating, or very, very few that are operating simply on a defensive basis to hold on to leases that they think will have value in the future. So that's what we're seeing right now. And then the natural gas that is coming out of the ground is coming because people are in wet gas plays like the Marcellus, or it's an ancillary product of the efforts in the Bakken or the Permian basin, places like that. So actually it's flat. And so I think there's an incredible story there watching all of this new demand come online, and with the assumption that there's going to be this explosion in growth in the underlying product. And there won't be until prices go up a lot again. And then there will be. People will drill again. But this is one of the things I'm absolutely confident on, that if people lose money at it, they stop doing it.
Well, plus, again, our research inputs tell us that there's a lot more oil being sold than they're reporting. So demand has been extremely strong, and perhaps those drawdowns are indicative of that. But it's all consistent with your research that, you know, we've hit this plateau combined with increasing demand. You know, the other thing, a couple things have happened since we last talked. One was we had the Treasury, well, the fixed income crash. So the 10-year went from 1.6 to, I think, 2.7, 2.7%.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to me, collectively, we're all kind of trapped down this blind alley. And so when they tried to let rates go up and they saw what happened to fixed income and all the assets that are priced off of that, then they had to back off. Then we saw the dollar decline as rapidly as I can't even recall a decline like that. So I think from a big picture standpoint, there's only one way forward, and that is to continue the QE, maybe taper it back a little bit, because you know, government expenditures have been declining for several years on a year over year basis. So there may be some room for that, but you know, they can't let rates go up, because that takes out all the sovereign budgets and you know, kill the housing market. So fixed income for us, at best, is going to be a bad investment. It's just going to sit there, and if rates were to rise, probably because they lost control, then it's going to cause destruction in price. And then if the government's successful at creating inflation, that's going to destroy it too. So any kind of fixed income is going to be a problem, and at best, it's just going to sit there and be a bad investment. And so what you're left with are, you know, some form of equity. And, you know, for a lot of people, they've been investing in real estate, and the median sales price has been pretty strong. And you know, people feel comfortable with that, at least, you know, certainly in the Bay Area, things are red hot. And then you have equities. And so if you're an institutional manager, if you know, typically you're supposed to keep like 60-40 between equities and fixed income. And if fixed income is generating flat returns, your only choice really is equities. You have to do something with it. And so I think that could be why the indexes have been lifted to the level they are. And the strength, when we do our screens for new ideas, the strength is coming in the small to medium-sized companies. And that's where the institutional investor is going to turn. Once they've bid up the big company stocks, and if people are switching out of bonds into stocks, you're going to see a tailwind on these small to medium-sized companies.
Well, it was June 19th, 20th, where we saw what was putatively a reaction to Bernanke's comments back then. Honestly, I saw interest rates were tailing off well before that moment, but it did accelerate. And what I saw during those 2 days, plus about half of the one that followed, was a sell everything mentality. And it so showed that there wasn't this sector rotation where people risk on, risk off, you know, chasing from equities back into bonds. Everything got dumped. And that was, to me, a pre-shadowing of what we might see, and not that we necessarily will, but that's what happened in 2008, and that's just a liquidity crisis. So the world has been creating all of this liquidity, and everybody has to keep doing it. That's one of the macro risks I see, or it gets, I don't know how it works. And so Europe has really got my attention. I don't know if Europe has the capability of going all in like the Fed has, for a variety of political reasons. Maybe they could, but because they'll think the alternative is worse. But the data that's coming out of Spain and Italy and Greece and Portugal is really quite atrocious. So are you keeping an eye on that and trying to factor that in, or how can anybody really factor in an unknowable risk, which is what EU bureaucrats may or may not do?
I just think Europe is lost because you know, the kinds of things that the U.S. can do with the money printing, I mean, certainly we can print money and shovel it over there, but it's not changing the underlying economics or the human suffering and, you know, job losses, all that. And so it really, the spotlight is on the U.S. as to what they're going to do. And so we have to, So I just, I feel terrible. I love Europe, but I just don't see any way out of it for them. You know, in China, you know, they just announced the GDP numbers, and you know, so I guess it's good that the number was what was expected, and so there wasn't any fallout. But you know, they've got their problems too, and so the United States, I do believe, is the strongest economy in the world, but it has its problems. So we need to fix our problems first, and I think that's going to benefit Asia and Europe at the same time.
How will that benefit?
Well, you know, there was a strong connection between the U.S. and China. There's a strong connection between China and Europe, and so these links are being broken. And once you break them, it's really hard to put them back together again. And so I think, you know, there's got to be, we need to fix these problems quickly and try to get people back on prosperity and wealth creation, or the links dry up and then there's problems everywhere.
Well, let's talk about a part of that prosperity part that, gosh, this is something I feel pretty firmly about, is that savings and investment are really critical components of future prosperity. And what are you seeing in terms of corporations actually investing in the future, capital expenditures? I know the oil industry, which I track closely, has been pouring, just shoveling money into CapEx. And they have some returns to show for it, but not as much as we would have seen in past times. So it looks like the return on equity is going down across that sector, even as profits remain high for the moment, when you look at expenditures on new efforts. But what about the general, you know, investing across the economy in ways that would have a real solid downstream return, you know, out in the future? What are you seeing there?
Well, I can just speak anecdotally. I mean, when I do the screens, you find a lot of the nuts and bolts companies, you know, Midwestern, valves, pumps, packaging, things like that. But you know, I see that all, to some extent, it's perpetuating the problem. I think the companies that with the money to spend are going to invest in productivity enhancing, you know, equipment, things like that. There's a generational problem with the workers. We can't bring true prosperity back until we get the workforce back engaged. And we've spent decades ignoring the workforce. And so to some extent, there's an incentive for the corporate ecosystem to try and make themselves more efficient, more profitable. And unfortunately, that often means less hiring. So it's, you know, it's when you think about what's going on, it's a very difficult task, because there are just so many moving parts here and so many things that have been occurring over a period of time. You know, to get this back on track is not an easy thing to figure out. I was thinking this morning, though, that, you know, money used to be a manifestation of wealth, accumulated deposits, somehow, at some time in recent decades, it's gone from being a manifestation of wealth to a way of creating wealth in people's minds. And that's a huge problem. And that's why we have, you know, we've lost price discovery, because there's no constraint about creating money out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And it's destroying any people who have maintained their wealth in money. You know, they're finally getting it, and they're finally going to artwork and real estate and gold and silver and things like that, because it's almost the money's almost become a disease that's destroying wealth instead of being a reflection of it.
That's an interesting observation. You know, I was taken by a study that a couple of Basel researchers did, not from the BIS, but from a university, and they were looking to ask the question about the spheres of influence and looking at all the boards of big corporations, and whittled it down and found that there are 147 companies through various levels of cross-ownership that basically control 40% of the world's wealth. And when you whittle that down to the top 50, I got my hands on that list and scanned it. Out of the top 50 companies, there are only two that are not financial companies, either banks or finance management companies. One of those is Walmart, and the other one is Sinopec. So it's kind of interesting that we've gotten ourselves to a point in time now where out of the top 50 companies in the world, 48 of them are just about managing money and articulations of money. And I bet you 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, that list would have been almost entirely inverted. And so that is an unusual condition in history. And I would caution listeners not to assume that today is just how that we've reached some new nirvana and pinnacle, and this is just how it's going to be. Things tend to swing back and forth, and we've come to through a very long period of intense concentration in and fascination with paper. And those companies certainly control a lot of wealth, but that doesn't actually, for the most part, create true wealth. It's just moving it around it's being very good at vacuuming money out of the money creation centers, which, by the way, are the central banks and their friends, the governments.
Well, I can think of instances in history. You know, always the Romans come to mind, and you know that's what they did. They set adrift their citizens. And eventually you've got problems. I was reading an article about inflation in Pakistan, and there was a sentence in there that the price of basics are becoming out of reach for the common man. And I thought, well, what does that mean? I mean, people have to eat and heat their homes and stuff like that. And so they're talking about it almost clinically, and that's a really bad situation. You know, we have to bring everybody up or there are going to be problems.
Well, and that's certainly been part of our strategy here in the United States, I think, with rising food stamp usage and other things. But it's pretty clear to me that with real incomes, median real incomes trending down for the past decade now, that it's just getting harder and harder for average families, median families to make it. And of course, that's if you buy the CPI, which is used to deflate the wages as a real arbiter of actual price increases that we're seeing. And we're not. We're experiencing something far higher than I believe we're admitting to. And you mentioned one of the other pieces in there, which is unemployment or employment. And those are the two pieces the Fed's looking at. You know, they want to see inflation above 2.5%. That's sort of their cutoff point for terminating their money printing. They want to see unemployment down below 6.5%. But when we look at the unemployment numbers, the headline numbers that get put out there that say we're having this sort of reasonable recovery in hiring, you don't have to scratch very far to discover that nearly all of those jobs that have been created, the vast majority of them, are part-time jobs. There's a variety of regulatory reasons for that, Obamacare being one. But I think corporations have fundamentally there's a new landscape for them, which is they can get away with whittling down the worker-employee contract to the bare bones, and that's sort of the new normal. So I don't see any strong chances for wages to really take off for hiring, to real substantial hiring of full-time jobs that have benefits and other things associated. I don't see a lot of hope on that horizon at this point. I see sort of a continuation of past trends. And here's where I get confused, Bob. I don't understand how you can have a robust economy without the people who are supposed to be participating in it, who do the lion's share of the consuming, are able to afford what's being sold. It's, you know, all the way back to Henry Ford saying, you know, I'm going to pay my workers $5 a day because I want somebody to buy my cars. That's been lost. I just, when I look at the weekly hours worked and wages paid and see where we are, it feels, that's something that I don't think the Fed has any plan for. And I don't have, nobody's been able to connect the dots that says, we buy mortgage-backed securities, here's how hiring gets better, because we haven't seen it and I don't understand it. So how do you see that part of the story, and where does that begin to turn around?
Well, it all doesn't fit. I mean, you know, just take the goal of creating inflation. If you have real disposable personal income taking a nosedive, and your stated objective is to create inflation, you're just pushing those people off a cliff. And if you create inflation, at least in the way it used to be, then interest rates go up. Well, we know you can't do that because of the budget deficit. So if you come up with biased numbers on the CPI, you succeed in creating inflation, but you keep the CPI low, people won't be getting higher wages. They're just going to be going further and further into a bad economic situation. So the things they're saying, when you add them all up, don't add all up. I just don't see how it all works. So I think it probably won't work. And so people need, as you pointed out, they need to be very cautious. The stock market, particularly the popular indexes, you know, that's that's potentially a real risk for people unless you get the underlying economy going. So they have to be cautious. They have to maintain their investments in real assets, and then they have to be very, very careful about the stock market, because none of what's being talked about makes any sense. It's not a plan that gets us to where we want to go.
All right. So if none of it makes sense, what's the plan then? How do you and I navigate these waters? How does the average investor approach these times? Say somebody who's 10 years off from retirement, how would they position themselves in this particular environment?
Well, you know, in the 70s, it used to be if you were a trustee that you could pay out dividends and interest, and that was it. But with inflation raging and, you know, real assets going up, they changed the rules so you could use total return. So we've always focused on that. And so what you want to do is generate the highest total return. Sometimes that's dividends, sometimes it's interest, sometimes it's capital growth. And then what you want is a bigger and bigger pie, a pot of money, and that can pay a bigger and bigger amount in retirement. Because they're, you know, as we discussed earlier, interest rates are still pathetic, and it's dangerous to own that stuff now if rates go up. So I think you have to make sure you've got plenty of real assets. If you are going to be in equities, you have to try and find businesses that can grow right through this. In the late 70s, in the last 3 years of it, the number one asset was gold, and number two, if I remember correctly, were high-growth companies. And, you know, in Silicon Valley, that was primarily semiconductor-related things. But so if you're going to buy a company, you don't necessarily want to go for the highest dividend. You want to go for a company that has a dividend, but it's growing rapidly so they can increase the dividend over time, not percentage-wise, but in dollars, to try and bolster your income too.
All right. So if you're looking at these markets and trying to think about the risks that are out there, how do you position yourself for the potential that, well, who knows, there could be another financial accident is a possibility, I suppose. We look at the Chinese stock market has done very poorly over time. And we look at contrast that with who's been doing really well. Well, I mean, the Greek stock market in the last year has outperformed the Chinese stock market. So, where do you factor in these larger global risks into that story? Is this a place where somebody can select some really high quality companies, look for total return, and, you know, sit on it, or does this require really active management at this point, do you think?
Well, I think if somebody's not doing it 24/7, or they don't have somebody that's doing it 24/7. I think the safest thing to do would be to build, if they don't have it, build positions in real assets, energy, gold and silver and the miners, things like that, and just invest in, if you're going to go in the stock market, go into higher, smaller companies, medium-sized companies that have strong growth potential, but also maintain a fair amount of cash. And cash is a lousy investment right now, but if you don't have your finger on the sell button all the time, you could get caught in another downdraft. And so it's, you know, there is no recipe, to be honest with you. It's a constant activity to not only watch the markets, but also watch the geopolitical stuff that's going on. So it's how we started the conversation. This is just the worst environment I've ever seen in my career.
Well, there you have it. It's one of the worst environments in over four decades. If somebody who's been paying really close attention, we've been talking with Bob Fitzwilson of the Portola Group. And Bob, I really want to thank you for your time today. And I'm sure we'll be back to continue to try and figure out and navigate these crazy markets.
Always my pleasure.